welcome back to the driver segment here on the Dirt Show, and it is my pleasure today to be joined by three-time Indy 500 winner and 13-time Pikes Peak Hill Climb winner, Bobby Unser. And Bobby, Pikes Peak Auto Hill Climb is the second oldest race in America. Your first year racing at this event was 1955. Championship drivers raced the Indy 500 and then came to Pikes Peak to compete. What do you remember about that very first year in 1955?
Oh, boy, that was a big year in my life. First off, Glenn, you need to remember that when I was like 8 years old, 10 years old, I was dreaming about going to Pikes Peak. I didn't dream of going to Indianapolis. I had no desire to go there. But I had a big, strong desire, even at that young age, to go to Pikes Peak. And I didn't know much about it, but I knew that my dad raced there. I knew that I had an uncle that I'd won it a bunch. That's Uncle Louie. And then I had Joe, my Uncle Joe, who got killed up there driving a race car in a test one day. And I knew all that stuff, but that's all I knew about it. And then by the time I got 15 or 16 years old, I was already winning a bunch of races here in Albuquerque, in New Mexico. At the age of 16, I don't want to bore you with all these facts, but it made a big difference. But at the age 16, I won the whole Southwestern Championship for grown men in the Super Modifieds. And so I became, so to speak, a child star. And I don't know why that I started winning so quick, but I did. And that was New Mexico, Southern Colorado, West Texas, and Arizona. And it just seemed easy to me. When the big shots, big racers would come to Albuquerque, seems like I always beat them, outran them. So I had quite an interesting start, but that's where my Pikes Peak stuff. I wanted to do it. Now, had I been able to, in those days they had a strict rule, call it a law, I guess, that 21 was the youngest that you could be. You had to be 21 to drive. In any of the big races, and this was what they called the AAA races. In other words, AAA is like the Motor Club. They used to do all the big-time racing in the United States. And so they had made the rules 21. Nothing else would work. And so I couldn't do it until I got up to that age. And then you never know if you're going to have the money to get there, if you're going to have the help. Would my father help, like eventually he did? But you don't know those things. And so that's how I got started. And then, of course, if you read in the book that you just did, you'll see that my brother Al drove for me one time. I was driving for my dad in the Jaguar car. And lo and behold, he was about just weeks shy of being 21, and they pitched him out. Now, what did that mean? That meant that I had two cars to drive. I didn't need two cars. So I tried to find somebody to put in the Jaguar because the other car belonged to me. In other words, I physically owned it. First race car I ever owned myself. And so I got into that, and things obviously went good. I had a good car, and I figured it was the fastest. So I tried to find another driver for the Jaguar. Couldn't find anybody that could go fast in it. So we just parked it. And that meant I had to give my dad 40%. He owned that car. I had to give my dad 40% of my winnings, because that would only be fair if it worked the other way, if I drove his car, see? So at any rate, long story short, I won that year with my own car. And boy, did I need money. And from that, it gave me my big start that I needed in doing things more myself, which was good. My dad was super smart and able to build cars, build a house, do electrical plumbing. He could build anything. And so that was really, really, really a good start in my life, having my own car, having to find the parts for it, buy them, make them, whatever we had to do. And it all started when I was like 8 to 10 years old. That's where it was in my head.
Glen Cove, Devil's Playground, Bottomless Pit. What was the most treacherous part of the Pikes Peak Mountain course?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I didn't have any places up there that I didn't like. You know, if you could just understand that when I was really young, for example, when I joined the Air Force, I got stationed at Cheyenne, and I'd race somewhere down in Colorado in the Saturday night jalopies, at least every weekend. And during that weekend, I'd take at least one day, maybe sometimes night, and drive up Pikes Peak. I knew where they hid the key to the gate. And so I'd go down there all by myself in my own car, 1949 Ford, and I'd go get the key under a rock, open the gate, go through it, lock the gate back up, and I'd have that whole mountain to myself except for the summit house. And obviously, I'd have a girlfriend up there that was working because the people didn't go up and down every day up there. They stayed up here overnight. So I'd go up there, find my girlfriend, sometimes take her to town, sometimes just drive up and down the road because it was Pikes Peak.
Some of those drops were 13,000 feet over the side, and you won that race 13 times. Six straight from 1958 to 1963, and then you returned in 1986 after not racing Pikes Peak for 12 years, and you were retired from racing for 5 years, and you won again. What did that mean to you?
Well, that was, you know, in a lot of ways, your first win is always your biggest. It's got to be that way. But you know, going back after 12 years, I did some runs for Audi cars down at Talladega, Alabama. And I did, I think, 14 world records around the Talladega track. And I had been out of, as you see in your records there, that I'd been out of driving Indy cars, Sprint cars, everything for a while. Now, I still did some side races. So people shouldn't think that I just quit, because I didn't do that. I don't think my body would have taken that. But I did run a few other races, and then I did that deal for Audi cars down in Talladega, Alabama, and I decided, gosh darn, you know, I've been missing this too much. I was getting dejected. I was getting bad feelings. I was getting the feeling like nobody wanted me anymore, you know, because I'd always been a famous race car driver, and I always won some races. No matter what I drove, where I went, I always won a lot of races. And now, all of a sudden, after 35 years of doing that, I'm not doing it anymore, and I just couldn't take it. So I did that deal for Audi cars at Talladega. That was so much fun, I couldn't even explain it in words. So after I did it in 3 days, I had to break their record. They needed to do 200 miles an hour. And they'd been trying, for example, for 3 years to do that. And they hadn't been over 184. That's with a couple of German drivers, didn't know who they were. And also, they snuck in a couple of NASCAR drivers because they needed some experience on that particular track. Well, nobody could get it over 184, and they had done it for 3 years, built three different sets of cars, and in 3 years, they hadn't been over 184. So I'm sitting at the same desk I'm talking to you on right now, and my phone rings one day, and it was Joe Hoppen from Audi Cars of America. He was the head guy with all of Audi racing in the United States. Smart man. Joe gives me a call, and he said, I need to talk to you. Would you get on a plane and come to Talladega? Well, gee whiz, I'm not that dumb. I've been doing this all my life. I already know if it's Joe Hoppen, what he wants, you know? And so I asked him a couple questions. He wouldn't answer them on the phone. Big secrecy event going on, see? So I went down there. The next morning, I was on the first plane leaving town. I got down there, took all day. Got down there and met Joe in the bar. That's where we always met and did business. And I asked him, I says, what are you trying to do? What's your goal? And I says, you're trying to run 200 or better, right? And well, he smiled and said, yes. He doesn't need to hide anymore because I'm there. So I said, I want to know the history of where they'd been. So I got the three-year thing, and then the last one I got was Neil Bonnet, one of NASCAR's best. He had snuck out there and tested it for them. And again, Neil's the one that ran 184. The Germans couldn't get over 180, something like that. So I says, well, give me Neil's phone number. I didn't have it with me, naturally. And so I got it from Joe, went down to my room, my hotel room, called him and asked him, why won't the car go any faster? Is the engine no good? Does it not handle good? Is it not safe? Things like that, because I hadn't seen it yet. And by golly, Neil told me it's a nice look. There's two cars. They have a spare. And he says, they're nice-looking cars. And I said, well, how about the engine? You got any power? And he says, lots of power, good power. No problem there. I says, well, then how come you can't run faster than 184? There's something wrong. He says, yeah. He says, you get right in the middle of the turn, it vibrates and shakes so bad that you lose your visibility. And I said, wow, that sounds like a bad car to me. And so, long story short, I hung up with Neil, went down to Joe, and I told him, okay, here's what the agreement would be. I'll go down the next morning early, and because the weather's better always. And I didn't know anything about Talladega, except I'd done television there. So I went down, and I looked at the car, and boy, good-looking cars. You know, they had two of them. And people had engineers all over the place, smart people. And then they had the head guy from Shell Oil there, the guy that made all the Formula One fuel, the debatable whether it was gas or not. And he was there. So that means I've got the smartest people you can imagine right in front of me there. I mean, people I've only read about in the books. And so I says, okay, I says, I'll go out and just take a test run in it and see. So I did. And I ran it two laps. And it did the same thing that Neil Bonnet told me it did. So I brought the car in, and I told the head engineer there, I says, I'm going to have to do a chassis setup on it. Now, this is what I'm really good at. In other words, I'm a good race driver. I knew that. But chassis is what I really know. And so I says, I'm going to have to do it. And he says, fine. He says, we have all the people here you could ever need. He says, you just tell them what you want, and he says, they'll do it. I says, well, no. I says, you don't understand. I says, I have to do it myself. I have to be under the car. I have to be working on it. I have to see what the setup on the car is. That's what I do. And they don't understand that because their drivers apparently don't do much except drive, see. And so at any rate, they said no. And finally I said, well, if that's the case, I'm just going to catch a plane and go back home because it has to be my way. That's the way I race. So they got over there and had a little meeting, about 15 or 20 of them, and had a meeting. Pretty soon the head guy came over and he says, okay. He says, anything you want. If you want to do it, you do it. I said, well, I want two of your mechanics. And they got to stay with me all the time. I want the Shell Oil guy. Because he spoke really good English. And I kiddingly always told him he spoke Albuquerque English, which is what I really needed, you know, because I have lots of ideas. And I think I know what we're going to have to do. So I sent some of the guys after some stuff down to the hardware store that I needed to start doing my setups. And they went down and got it, which is nothing but some rulers and some clear hose, you know, some plastic hose, so I can level things out. In other words, I have a system that I do. And by God, those guys came back with that stuff, and I put it all together, and then I leveled the floor. I mean, they were operating, doing their setups on a crooked floor. And you can't do that. And so I straightened that stuff out, and then I started doing the setup on the car. And, you know, this is springs, bump rubbers, shock absorbers, things like this. And I did it fast. And I had their two mechanics. Boy, those guys knew the car, and they were fast. So we put it together. By noon, I took the car out again and ran 206 miles an hour. I became one of the most famous guys in Germany instantly. And so that was just a storybook affair that they could not believe. And the car handled really well, had a lot of engine, just had good people, good engine people. The gasoline stunk so bad I could hardly stand the smell of that, but that's because technically wasn't even gasoline, but Formula One guys said it was, you know. So that ended that, and then in the next day I did 14 records, world records. And then the next morning I started on tire testing. In the next 2 days I tested 350 Michelin tires. And of course picked out the tires that'd be good for this track, that track, whatever. That's another thing that I was really good at. So I did that, and the problem was I did all of that in 3 days. Now I get on an airplane, I come back to Albuquerque, and I'm sitting here at my desk thinking, why in the world did I do that so fast? Why didn't I spend a couple of weeks? Money was no problem. I spent millions of dollars on this project. So I got back here, and I'm mad at myself. That's stupid. As bad as I need to drive a race car, I need some action. And so I went to work, and I came up with the idea. I said, you know what I need to do? I know. By listening, call it the underworld, call it the things I'm not supposed to know. I know they got a really trick Pikes Peak car. And it's not built yet, but the one the year before was just awesome fast. And that happens to be the one that the real, real, real pretty girl drove, Michelle Mouton. And she drove on the World Rally, so she's very good. So she went to Pikes Peak the year before. This is what got me all stirred up. And she set a new record up there. And now she's screwing in my house. You know, this is a Bobby Unser territory. And so it really riled me up. And so I called Joe Hoppen back on the phone, and I says, hey, I want to run Pikes Peak for you this year. And he says, oh, you can't. The big chairman of the board, his favorite guy is Walter Rowe. He's a rally champ, and a good one, and a good race driver. But I said, no, you know, I'm not getting any younger. So I said, no, I have to do it this year. Take Walter Roll next year. Fine. And they just said no. I says, well, now, I know how to play hardball, too. So in Talladega, remember, I told you I did 3 days. That's all. I never signed an agreement. I never shook hands with anybody on agreements, which would be the same as a contract to me. And I just told him on the phone. I says, you can't use that Talladega, all those records I set, world records. You can't use it unless you do Pikes Peak with me. And boy, the phone got really quiet. And pretty soon Hoppen says, I'll call you back. So he hangs up the phone, and the next day he calls me back again. He says, can you leave for Germany right away? Now that means, because I understand this business, that they're going to give me a test deal in Germany. Kind of stupid maybe, but that's all right. It's going to be fun no matter what for me, you know. So I jump on an airplane, head over there. The time I got there, they'd lost my bag on the airplane. Didn't have a helmet, didn't have clothes, didn't have anything. I didn't care. I just needed to get that race car going. I needed to see what this is all about, because I'm really playing hardball on going back to Pikes Peak, and I realize that I've been gone for a long time. 12 years is a long time. Everybody, it was in the newspapers, they all started saying, or not all of them, but some of them, that Bobby's been gone too long. He's lost his timing. He's lost all the knowledge that he has at Pikes Peak on where the turns go, and just all the things that are important up there that I knew so well. But to me, I just said, no. I've been gone for 12 years, but man, I ain't been sitting still for 12 years. I have won dozens and dozens of races, all types of cars, been all over the world. And so, no, I'm going to be okay. Just get me a car. Let me go, you know, let me get back to what I used to do. And so finally they decided, when I went to the Michelin test track with the rally cars, I broke all their records again. Even the Peugeot records I broke with an Audi rally car. And they just could not believe this. And I did it fast and easy. Like, I started at 7 in the morning, and by noon I'd already been in the shower, got all cleaned up, and was looking to go get something to eat. And my day was finished. And I'd broken all of the records at the Michelin test track. And so I know that I've got my timing. Just not, I got to sharpen it for sure. But it's back. And so they built the race car. And I started testing it. They brought it to Colorado. I didn't want to go up on the Pikes Peak Highway right away. I wanted to go find some roads where I could do some playing with their technologies, because they've got a lot of technology. They've got, for example, some people will understand this. They have a turbocharger that once I flip a little switch on, it never shuts off, and you never lose your turbo pressure. So in other words, when I set at the starting line, the car is running, I'll speed the engine up to like 4,000 RPM, which is nothing. That's like a fast idle. And I'll flip that little switch on. I'll have 3.5 bars of blower pressure. I mean, this has not been accomplished anywhere in the world except by Audi. And it's so secretive, they're hoping they don't even have to show it to me. Which can't happen. If it's there, I can see it. I'm too smart on that stuff. And at any rate, I figured that stuff out, and I went from place to place on the west side of Pikes Peak. People get mad, call the sheriff. Sheriff would come out. He was a friend of mine. I'd go to another place. He'd go back to his office, then come and chase me again. Not chase me, but tell me, Bobby, you can't keep doing this. But by that time, I basically had all my technical things figured out. So now we went over and started renting the highway. In the old days, we didn't have to rent the highway, Pikes Peak. But now we do. But Audi's not broke. They have lots of money. So I go over there and start running on the hill climb. Well, now since I'd been gone that 12 years, they had new records for test places, for practice places, and they had all of that. Well, the first thing I did is wiped out all of those records and just kept making the car faster and faster and faster. And also, when you pay the big money to rent the highway, you can go any place you want. And I can do it before they turn the tourists loose on it. So I just had a friggin' ball up there and just got going better and better and better. So now you get into the book that you read. They missed the time on my qualifying, but didn't make any difference. I set a big-time qualifying record, and they did figure out their mistake. And then in the race, of course, I set the record again. And the world, only the people that know how my head operates would know how happy I was to win that thing in 1986. And a new record again. And I had told them ahead of time, I mean, that girl was awfully pretty that won it the year before. But I just told him, I says, I just can't let a pretty girl not start knocking my records off. So there went another one, see? So that was probably one of the biggest days in my life, the last race.
How did you get involved in Indy cars in 1963, and what was your first impression of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when you walked through the gate?
Well, back to Pikes Peak again, okay? And this goes back into the early 60s. At any rate, I'm at Pikes Peak, and I meet the guy by the name of Parnelli Jones. He's up there driving for Ford Motor Company, Mercury Division. And this is a factory effort, and a big effort, because Chrysler was there, Chevy was there, Pontiac was there. All the factories were running the stock cars, and they were real stock cars then. And they brought Parnelli up to run Mercury. So, of course, I met him. I didn't know him from my sprint car days and stuff like that, but obviously I knew of him. Most famous driver during that era in the United States. So, believe it or not, we became instant friends. We weren't in the same division at Pikes Peak. He's running a stock car, I'm running my own race car. Most likely, I was going to win it. I had a fast car, and I did win it. But Parnelli and I became super good friends, and I showed him all my little tricks up there things to do to the chassis, things that he does with his eyes, with his feet, his hands, how he looks at turns, how he tells which way turns go, when he's going to have a straightaway, when he's going to have turns, you know? I mean, we just were together every single day. So we became extremely good friends. And one day, he just said to me, he says, why don't you come and run Indianapolis? And I says, no, I don't think I'm good enough to do that. That's not been in my desires. I says, I'd rather run Pikes Peak. I'd rather run some sprint car races, some midget car races, stuff like that. Stock cars, okay, anything. But my brother had gotten killed at Indianapolis, my brother Jerry. And he got killed in 59, so that starts getting our years better sorted here. And in 59, I got in a really, really, really serious screwing around go-kart accident in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that took a year out of my life. So 1959 just disappeared in my life. I naturally just tore up. My head was broken. My spinal fluid was running out my right ear. I was in bad shape, and I stayed that way for a year. So to make a long story short, that year after Parnelli left, I remember, we both won that year. So when he got back to California, he called and found a race car for me to drive at Indianapolis for the next May. And I just can't believe it. But now I can't turn it down. I mean, it's a AAA approved deal. I mean, I'm actually supposed to go to Indianapolis, take my driver's test, and hopefully be capable of going fast enough to make the race. And I don't want to. It was the funniest thing about the whole thing. But I do it anyway. And I get back there, and Parnelli had me a car. Well, the car was good for a driver test, but not a good car. Terrible car. So long story short, Parnelli saw the car was no good. He just told the mechanic, Bobby quit. Now I don't have any car. So Parnelli walked me right down to Andy Granatelli in the Novi car. Now, remember, I'm going from one of the worst cars there to one of the most powerful cars. Well, not one of, the most powerful car at the racetrack. And Parnelli told Andy, he says, I'd appreciate it if you give Bobby a little test ride in your car. Well, Andy wasn't going for it, but Parnelli talked him into it. And so I ran down to the shop, got my uniform on, came back out, got in that Novi, nothing fit, but I didn't care. I just needed to get into something that handled well and that had an engine in it that would go, you know? And so I got into it, and what, in three or four laps, I'm running one of the fastest cars in the whole race. It was just like a miracle that happened. And so I had the Novi. Now I became famous all over the world because the Novi car is the most famous race car in the United States in those days. So I became instantly famous. And so it's kind of like anything you want, you have. Now, I made the race fifth fastest qualifying time. That's another miracle. It should have never happened. But it did. The car fit me good. And it was all Parnelli. And in the meantime, Parnelli had gone and got me another car to drive, if I didn't like that one, that was identical to his car, which he was the fastest guy at the track. And so I just kept telling Parnelli, I says, no, I don't want to get another. I don't want a Watson car with the Offie in it. I don't want that. I says, that friggin' Novi likes me, and I like it. And I says, I'd just rather do that. Granatelli gave me a great big fee to drive it, $1,000. Now, that's nothing, but it was a bunch to me. So I had a real car to drive. Got into the race, started the, didn't qualify till the third day because the other days were already gone by. So that meant I'm going to start way in the back, but the fifth quickest car in the race. And so they dropped the green flag, and what did I do? I mean, I promptly wrecked. I mean, the second lap of the race, I had a wreck, and I'm out of the race. And ironically, it didn't hurt my reputation. Should have killed it, but it didn't hurt it. So I just go, the race is over, I'm out of it. The crowd was happy, sad for me wrecking it. And I get on the championship circuit and trying to find race cars to drive. And I find them, because once you drive the Novi, wow, everybody knows you. I don't care if it's the dog catcher. He's going to know you if you drove the Nova, you see. And so I did that all year, got a good car to drive, didn't have it steady, but drove it for Gordon Van Loof, Vita Fresh Orange Juice car, Watson, brand new car, brand new good offy engines. I mean, nice stuff. And so I did that for that year, and of course, Granatelli hires me the next year. And I get the first all-wheel drive that's going into Indianapolis. And the car was fast. But, you know, we had that Eddie Sachs, Dave McDonald big fire. I forget what year that was. But the two guys got killed in that big fire, big wreck. Well, I lost my car into that. I got involved into the wreck also, but I didn't get burned all that bad. I just got kind of minor burns. And so one more year I did Granatelli, and he did me a lightweight all-wheel drive. And real secretly made and blah, 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 you know. Well, everything was fine except I was out practicing with a car. It was going to be very fast. And Ebb Rose from Texas spun in front of me, and I hit him. Nothing I could do. And so there went my good car. So we got the old one back out, and I ran that and went good in the race until the car had an oil line or something came loose in it. So I dropped out of the race. So now after that, see, that ended that's 3 years with Granatelli. 3 years with the team that, in a lot of ways, Parnelli put together. He totally put it together for me with Granatelli. But then he ended up driving the turbine in 1967, and he led the whole friggin' race, except for burned out a bearing in the transmission, right at the last, very last. So that kind of ended that. Granatelli is trying to hire me after that again. In the meantime, though, I got a really good team. In other words, I've really, really, really gone a long ways. Don Branson was going to retire. He had one of the best teams there, and he even wanted me to take over his job. And that was leader card team. Roger Ward had already won twice for them. In other words, I went from little teams, not so good, into the best, and just almost overnight. So I got in with Judd Phillips, the chief mechanic, and it was my car. Unfortunately, Branson had gotten himself killed the latter part of the season before that, out in California at Ascot. But nonetheless, it had already been planned. That was my car. That was my team. And they're good people. I mean, I had the best now. And so I just started doing better in racing. We started buying Dan Gurney Eagle cars, and all I did was go faster and faster and faster. And by golly, by the time the next year come around, I'm winning races. I won my first Indianapolis car race at Mossport, Canada, in this car that I just described. In fact, I won two of them that day. And those were my first ever wins in an Indy car. Then the next year, I won four of them in a row. Then went to Indianapolis and won that sucker, too. And so I really was cooking good, you know. Good team, good cars. And, of course, Goodyear and Firestone, that's where the money was in those days. That's where the money came from. My money came basically from Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. And I had to work my way into being one of their best, if not the best, tire tester that they had. And I did this almost every week. And, of course, all I do when I do that is get better. In other words, you sharpen your skills. And you learn more about the car. Goodyear might tell me I'm not supposed to be working on the car, not supposed to be adjusting it, but I sneak it underneath them. They don't even catch me doing it. So I'm always doing testing and making the car go faster. And before you know it, Goodyear, Dan Gurney decides he's going to retire. His wife said, no more for you. He hadn't been hurt, not going to get hurt. And so Goodyear called me and said, would you take a ride in Gurney's car if we send it back for next week's tire test? So I said, well, you know, this is strange. You know, I'm driving for a good team now. Why would you guys want to put me into another one? Well, it's a high-buck thing, high-buck team. And Dan builds his own cars and things like that. And, of course, I don't know what to say. But if Goodyear wants me to do it, that's where my money comes from. Goodyear wants me to do it, I'm going to do it. They really like me now. I mean, I've come from Pikes Peak with Goodyear. I took them up there, and I mean, I'm running for them as one of their lead, if not their total lead driver, testing every week somewhere. Phoenix, Ontario, Indianapolis, somewhere, Michigan. And so I just said, wow, this is really nice. Yeah, if you want me to try that car out, I don't know if they have a problem with Gurney's car. I don't know what it is. But I said, yes, if you want it, I'll do it. Well, I did it, and of course, I went faster in his car. He sent back his very best people. I mean, I got an engine man that you can't imagine what that friggin' engine guy would do, you know? I mean, I'm running what I call a junk engine in the tire test. I get into one of Gurney's engines with John Miller. Wow, I'm flying. And so naturally, when I go fast, everybody wants me. Goodyear says, that's where we want you. Gurney says, I want you. And so I become the number one driver on the Gurney All-American Racers team. Now, I hated to leave Wilkie, but, you know, I mean, Goodyear spends millions where he spends $1,000. And it's just a big difference. You know, I'm never out of money. Plus, my contract money is quite good. In other words, they pay you money to sign a contract. And I'm telling you what, it was just like, it's like dying and going to heaven, you know? I mean, you just had everything that you could want. And that's how all that stuff happened.
A couple of seasons ago, I had Mario Andretti on the show. Like yourself, he is a real class act and a genuine ambassador for the sport.
No doubt.
You and Mario used to fly together to the races, and it sounds like the plane was maybe a little iffy.
Well, a lot of my old planes were really iffy. Really iffy. But it's all I had. You got to remember, I almost lived in an airplane. Sometimes I'd fly to a sprint car race and land the airplane and just do nothing. Just sit there and lean over against the window and try to get an hour or two of sleep before the friggin' sprint car race starts, you know? And I used to do this often. Mario and I both would. Maybe he'd get in and lean up against the right window. I'd lean up against the left one. And I did this with Branson, with Mario, Roger McCluskey. You know, you become good friends with these guys even though you have to race them every weekend, you know? In other words, those are the best that I just named. None of us had a lot of money. Mario didn't have any money in those days. Branson damn sure didn't have any money. McCluskey, come on, he came from Tucson. Same as me, used to run a garage. He had no money, you know, but the good race drivers. And so we would just travel together, do everything together, tire tests together often, travel in my airplane. They didn't have airplanes at the time, and mine wasn't very good at the time. They got better over the years, but they weren't so good then. But it was fun, and it was safe. And, you know, I teach them how to help me, like I need to get a little sleep while I'm flying. So I teach McCluskey how to use one instrument, and you just keep these two lines together. And I says, if anything else happens, wake me up. That's it. And hell, we travel the whole United States constantly like that. Every week, two or three times a week, we'd be going somewhere.
1969 and 1974, you won the USAC National Driving Championships. I look at your competition in that era, A.J. Foyt, Gary Bettenhausen, Larry Rice, Tom Bigelow, Poncho Carter, Johnny Parsons Jr., and many, many more. What an incredible era full of top talent.
You know, that made it so much fun. For example, I got to tell you in about one race in particular that I never could get put to bed, and that was Terre Haute, Indiana. Terre Haute was the biggest sprint car race of the year. And I'd run there every friggin' year that they'd have a race there. And I led a lot of them. But always I'd break, hardly ever an engine. But like one time I'm leading that thing, and I ran what's called the cushion. People that are racers will know that's the high end of the racetrack, the top end. That was like my favorite place to be. And I ripped the right header clear off. The mud was too deep up there, the cushion was. And I ripped the header off and lost probably 25% of my horsepower. But I led that thing all the way until that happened, and I would have won that race that day if I hadn't knocked the header off. and so that's okay. Then I go along in a lot of years. And then before you know it, probably somewhere around 68, Don Shepherd, my car owner, calls up and says, we're going to go to Terre Haute. And I said, no. I says, Shep, you're going to have to find somebody else to drive it this year. I'm not going to drive sprint cars anymore. And he says, well, why? I says, because Foyt quit, McCluskey quit, Branson got killed, and I started naming off all of these guys that are going to be gone. And they're all the big names. And Mario quit. I mean, everybody that I was racing against in the sprint cars, all of a sudden, just shut the door and quit running sprint cars. So I said, well, man, I am not going to be the target for all the rookies and the new guys that are coming along. They're all going to be shooting at Bobby Unser. And I said, I don't think I want to do that. The fun's gone. If I can't run against Foyt and Branson and McCluskey and all these guys, the fun's gone. Rutherford was terribly good. And I mean, you look at all of these things, and I just said, that's it. So then I'm over at the Speedway. I think it's early May, if my memory is right. And the phone rings for me in the race shop back there. And so it's Mutt Anderson. This is the car. This is the best sprint car in the USAC sprint cars. But McCluskey, it was basically McCluskey's car. You know, if he keeps running, it's his. I know that. But also I heard McCluskey quit. He's not going to run either. So Mutt calls me on the phone and he says, you want to run Terre Haute? And I says, no, Mutt, I'm out of the sprint cars. I'm not going to run the sprint cars anymore. I said, shit, everybody quit. They're all going to be shooting at me. I said, if I drove your car, they're all going to be shooting at that thing. And he says, Bobby, he says, you never won Terre Haute. I said, oh, shoot. Oh, this can't be. Why would a man do that to me that's got the best sprint car in the country at that time? And I just stood there almost shaking. I said, Mutt, I'll be there. I'm going. Get that friggin' car ready. So he did, and I went there and just wiped them out. I mean, kicked butt, you know, really good. Let them know, you know, that car was really suited for me that day. The track was really good. The cushion was there. Everything I needed, and I wiped them all out. All the new guys that thought the only guy they had to pick on was Bobby Unser, they found out that wasn't an easy one, you know.
Bobby, a little local connection that you probably don't even realize. You also ran some USAC stock car races back in the early 70s, winning the Miller High Life 200 in Wisconsin. And I don't know if you knew this, but you were followed by one of our local drivers, Verlin Aker of Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, which is about 16 miles away, who finished second. Do you remember that race?
No, I remember the race. I have the trophy. I can look at it right now. I'm looking at it with my eyes. It's one of those grandfather clocks that sits on the floor, you know, goes ding-dong every hour, you know. And I promoted that trophy. My car was so good for that race, and I had so many special things done to it, not cheating. It wasn't a cheater. Foyt always had the cheater. The fair was going on. I went over to the fair, and this guy selling these big clocks, as tall as I am, and I talked the guy into putting one up for a trophy to anybody that broke the qualifying record the next day. So he did that. And so I set a new record and got the clock. And it is sitting right here. I can look at it right this second. And there's a picture of the car that I did it with. And that was so much fun because the stock cars, I became pretty good in the stock cars. I knew what I was doing, and I didn't drive cars unless they were good ones after a while. In other words, factory cars, Ray Nichols, factory Dodge. I mean, whatever I drove after that Ford, drove for Holman and Moody. I mean, that's the Ford factory Ford, you know? Foyt would be doing it, too. He had a Ford, I had a Ford. Let's throw down. Let's have a good race. And it was really fun doing the stock cars. I mean, Ralph Moody, you know, Holman and Moody. Ralph Moody really liked me. And so when he had a weekend off, meaning he didn't have to go to some NASCAR race or whatever, he'd call me on the phone. He'd go out to their junkyard, cars that had been wrecked. He'd go out there and find a car, go get an engine off of the shelves up there, because they built hundreds of engines, and put that car together. Call me up, and he'd say, let's go run the dirt race at Indianapolis. And that's Ralph Moody. That's number one friggin' thing. And so I'd do it, you know? I mean, not only do it, man, I'd love it, you know? Car wouldn't even have windshield washers and wipers. It's a muddy track. And so we use wood, and I tape some rags on the end of it and put me a jug inside the car. So when I have a yellow flag, I put that thing in the water, reach around the corner, wash my windshield off. But the car went fast. And so I had fun doing those things. I mean, I drove for Harry Hyde and NASCAR. I drove the best stock cars that there were. I didn't do it regularly. I didn't want to do that because Indianapolis cars were my cup of tea, see? But I had a good time doing that, I promise you.
One item that really caught my eye being from Minnesota was the record-setting Chaparral snowmobile that you built.
I'm just a nervous, hyper person, you know, and love snowmobiling. My brother got me into snowmobiling. In 1968, snowmobiles were junk then. But Al called up and he says, hey, because he needed my name. I was winning the races in those days. And Al did later, but not right then. And he called up and he says, we need to go promote some snowmobiles. That means they needed me, see? And so get a hold of one of the factories. I wasn't a very good one. And we got snowmobiles. And when we'd finish with them at the end of the year, we'd give them back to them. They were junk. And so pretty soon, I became interested in the snowmobiles, the design. And so Chaparral was made in Denver. That's really close. That's only 400 miles from me here. And I got airplanes, you know. I can go up there anytime I want. Gasoline and airplanes wasn't so expensive in those days either, you know. I'd probably buy gas for 50 cents or 75 cents a gallon. And so I went up to Chaparral, and I'd look around their race shop and see what they were doing, and nice people. And before you know it, the president of the company asked me to come in his office, and he was hitting on me to run the race team. In other words, be their boss for their racing. Now, they had never made the finals at Eagle River. That would be equivalent to the Indy 500. They'd never made it. So his name was George Walker. So George asked me, he says, what would it take? How much would we have to pay you? And he says, we've never made the finals at Eagle River. And I stood there for a while, and I looked at him. This is the head of the company. He's serious. And so I told George, I says, tell you what I'll do. I says, I'll run all your racing for you. I'll run the factory team, and I'll be the race engineer. I'll be everything. And I got good helpers, but nonetheless, I'll be the boss. And I says, we'll go to Eagle River. And I says, if we make the race, the final, 10 sleds, because we won out of probably 100 or 150 sleds that went there to try to make the race. And I says, if we make it, I didn't say win it, if we make it, I'll have a party of my choice at the end of the year. Well, now this seems kind of dumb to George, you know. He says, geez, that's nothing, you know. One party? No problem. So George just sticks out his hand, gives me a handshake. I said, okay, so I go to work. And I built what you know got built. I designed that. The guys that work in the race shop up in Denver, I mean, they become my good friends. And we all learn to speak the same language. Because I live in Albuquerque, and I only fly up there and take a look at things when I need to. And I have a ranch up in Chama, New Mexico. That's up against the Colorado border in the mountains. And there's a racetrack up there. So I have a good place to test. Plus, I got an airport. And I do a lot of the testing on my airport. So make a long story short, I designed their stock sleds. I designed the racer. And that thing became just unbeatable. That thing was just lightning fast. Today, it's still one of the most sought-after old sleds that there are. Everybody in the country's trying to buy the one I have over here, but I won't sell it to them, you know? I mean, I changed the whole industry. And coming out soon, and I don't know which magazine, Olaf Hahn, he makes stuff for snowmobiles, big. He's doing and has finished doing a story on snowmobiles that has to do with this era where Bobby Unser started doing all this new type of designing. That guy put independent suspensions on them. I went to work and made special engines. Those were done up in Denver also. Shock absorbers, hydraulic shock absorbers. They'd never had them before. Snowmobiling didn't know what this was about. So I did all of this stuff. And I roll bars on them, sway bars, whatever you want to call them. Everything you could imagine. I put Bobby Jr. on the sled that I have over here, and we won the Western Championship with it. And people just couldn't understand it. They would look at these weird things. Oh, I also put wings on them for a while. Of course, they outlawed that really quick, you know, said it was unsafe. Jeez, all I was doing was breaking records everywhere, winning all the races, you know. And so my snowmobiles became famous. And this guy by the name of Olive has a big article that will be out soon in one of the leading magazines. They had to get down and find out who really changed snowmobiling and made it a high-tech race. And it was Bobby Unser. And this guy got into it and did all of the checking on everything. And that made me proud. So, you know, I got my little machine over here, set in my race shop over here. We never started anymore, but I also cleaned it up a little bit, and it looks pretty nice now, you know. This year I'm going to get inducted into a big sports hall of fame because of doing all of this. Somewhere in Wisconsin, I think it is. Not till September.
Your son Robbie ran sprint cars here in Minnesota at the Jackson Nationals in 1985. He also ran Indy cars, a 9-time winner of the Pikes Peak Hill Climb. What is Robbie doing now?
Well, he doesn't do any more racing. He works for Speedway Motors. Robbie was exceptionally good and quick in anything racing. He was fast. And then down in Texas at the Texas World, down there he had a bad wreck one night, and he got himself hurt. It wasn't a permanent hurt, but it was a bad one. And I think that just turned his head around. It's the only thing that we could ever figure out that stopped him from racing, because he started going slow, and you could obviously see that he's been bit, you know. This is usually what happens to a lot of the drivers that get into bad wrecks, and they don't recover from them really well. And I think that happened to Robbie. He still has the talent, but he doesn't have the desire to go out there and do it, win, in other words.
Bobby, thank you so much for the memories. I'll never forget sitting in the living room watching the wide world of sports and watching the Indy 500 and you going under the checkered flag and all of the racing coverage.
It's so much fun to talk about it. It's a fantasy world, you know, because I wanted to do it so bad. What people don't understand is today I'm considered to be a pretty well-to-do person. I didn't need money. I didn't need money. Money didn't make me race. In other words, money makes a lot of the drivers race today, but it never made me race. Winning was the only thing that was ever important to me, and I learned it from the best, guys like Parnelli. I mean, to tell you what, some of those people really, really, really race hard. Foyt, too. He didn't have to have money to race. He had to win. Mario. I mean, those guys were all basically the same. McCluskey. I mean, that son of a gun race harder for nothing than he would for a whole bunch. And they just don't do that today, you know? And it was really fun, and that's the way I lived. My racing was so important. I'd go to bed at night, I'd be dreaming about it. I'd wake up at 1 to 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about something to do to the race car. I just loved it. It's good sport. Best dang sport there is, you know?